Okay, this is the hour of phone calls now with Bob Zimmerman. So we'll do that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. As a space historian, Robert, what's your favorite story?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. It's a very good question, George. What's my favorite story?
And you've touched them all.
Oh, man. I mean, you know, I wrote a whole book about the Apollo 8 mission to the moon, and that story on its own is maybe my favorite story, the whole story, why they read the Bible while on Christmas Eve,
yeah.
What made that happen. The first Earthrise picture. I mean, this is something achievement in researching that particular story. I solved the mystery of who took the first Earthrise picture, because there had always been an argument between Frank Borman and Bill Anders about who took it. And digging into the original files, I discovered that there was an unknown, very never before published black and white Earthrise picture that, based on where the Earth was closer to the horizon, it had to have been taken first. And what apparently happened was that Borman grabbed the camera, took a picture when they had black and white film in there. They quickly changed the film to put color in, and then Anders took the color picture that everyone is so familiar with. In the subsequent time, with everything going on, these guys forgot about changing the film. And so Borman, for many years, thought he took the famous Earthrise picture.
I see.
And when I showed Borman the black and white and Anders the black and white, they said, oh. I showed them the transcript. They said, oh. And that they said, yeah, that explains it. Because Anders said to me, he can never understand why Borman was trying to claim credit for this. Because Anders knew he took that color picture. But Borman took a picture, too. But, you know, when you look through the lens of a camera, you don't see black and white. You see color. So he thought he was taking a color picture, though it was black. And, you know, later on, he sees the color picture. He assumes it's his picture. But he took a black and white image, and it never got published anywhere. It wasn't published until my book, Genesis Story of Apollo 8, was published.
That's great.
So that's one story, yeah. I mean, I could go on.
I was having a dinner a couple weeks ago with Edgar Mitchell and a group of people at an X conference looking for UFO disclosure in Washington, D.C. And I said, Edgar, I'm hearing some rumors here about you. I said, you're going to tell me? And he said, okay. Apollo 14 astronaut, been on the moon. He said he seriously is thinking of going back up on a shuttle mission that would make him the oldest person ever to go into space. Isn't that cool?
Yeah. You know, but you know, you talk to almost every astronaut, they'll all say the same thing, though. I want to go.
They do want to go.
I want to go. Yeah, they would love to go again, almost all of them.
Only one has.
Yeah.
John Glenn.
Yeah, that's right, Glenn. He's the only one who's, but you know, he knew how to play the politics to get the seat. Most of the other guys, have, you know, when they get older, it's not so easy. But I wouldn't be surprised. You know, I've always said that some, like Virgin Galactic, it would be good public relations for them to give a seat to one of the surviving Mercury astronauts.
Absolutely.
Great public relations. They haven't done it, but I can't see why not. It makes great. There are guys that would do it. Carpenter would go again. Never got to fly again after the Mercury program. He would love to get back.
Who's left now with Mercury?
Wally, well, let's see. Shepard passed away.
Shepard's gone. Wally Schirra has passed away.
Yes.
He's gone.
You've got Grissom died, you know,
Grissom
in
died.
That accident. You've got Carpenter. You've got Gordon Cooper. Gordon Cooper's still alive.
No, Gordon Cooper died.
He did?
Yeah, he died about a year and a half or so ago.
You know, I can't keep track of this. They're going. Very slowly. There's no question of that.
And John Glenn.
Yeah.
We've got him. I think we're missing one, though. Let's see. One more time. We got Shepard. Okay.
Grissom was the next.
John Glenn.
Then Glenn. Then Schirra.
Then Schirra.
Not Conrad.
But Cooper. Put him in. That's
Cooper.
Five.
Cooper was the last.
Five.
Carpenter was before, actually. Six. That's right. Six. Six guys flew. Deke Slayton was the seventh.
He had
who did not fly
right.
In the original Gemini program. He didn't get to fly until the Soyuz Apollo docking back in 75 because he had a heart condition and he decided, that was very minor, but they decided not
to. We went through that time period, Bob.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. You know,
I wonder how many Americans were kids
Not many. And that, you know, once again, where time is passing, you know, this is one of the reasons I write the history, because it should not be forgotten. And there'll come a time where no one will be alive anymore from that period. And the only way you will know what happened is from the histories that were written and the records that are left. And though Americans as a nation were very good at documenting what we do, it's very important that it get the story be told repeatedly. Look, when I wrote Leaving Earth, the last book, and similarly when I write Universe in the Mirror about Hubble's history, these are stories that need to be told. Hubble, for example. There was an academic history of Hubble that was written back in 1990 and then updated in 93 after the repair. But it was an academic history. The guy who wrote the history did a good job. He interviewed all the important players. When I was starting to research Universe in the Mirror, I started to listen to those interviews. And I was astonished at what the academic historian had left out. There was tragedy in this story about people's careers being destroyed to build this telescope. The guy, Bob Udell, who was the project scientist for 10 years, he literally destroyed his career as a research astronomer to make the telescope happen. And he talks about about that in the interviews, and it's tragic to listen to it and got left out of the academic story. And I said, this has to be told. People have to know about this. Because that telescope is absolutely one of the great landmarks of American history, a great achievement. And the people who made it happen sacrificed things to make it happen. And we should remember and honor their memory. And that's why I wrote the story.
That deep space photograph, when they just shot it into nothing?
Yeah, the ultra deep field.
Oh, my gosh.
Field, yes.
And
you couldn't have taken that picture without the sacrifice of people like Lyman Spitzer and Bob Odell and others who gave up years of what they loved, which is astronomical research, to become managers and paper pushers to make a telescope get built. But they made it possible for generations later, next 50, they were like Moses. They didn't cross into the promised land. By the time the telescope was in orbit and fixed, these guys were already out of the picture. So they didn't get to benefit from the work they did, but everybody else did.
As promised,
tragic story.
Phone calls for the rest of the hour with Bob Zimmerman. Let's go to Scottsdale, Arizona. First-time caller. Hello, John. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Mr. Zimmerman. You are an enchanting and enigmatic storyteller. I want to know if you're going to branch out into any other subjects. And also, President Kennedy was the coolest, most visionary president ever. And I just want to know if George W. Bush and Obama's space program will turn out to be the same kind of thing.
John, what I plan to do next, that's interesting. A new book idea is percolating in my brain, but I can't talk about it because it's only percolating, and I'm not ready yet to go. But it's going to be a little bit more it'll have to do with more about science and the nature of science and how research is done and why humans pursue it. As for Kennedy's vision versus George W. Bush's vision, in many ways, Bush's proposal back in 2004 was the most visionary proposal for NASA since Kennedy, and in some ways might even be better than Kennedy's, because Kennedy was a very specific goal: go to the moon and come back by the end of the decade. Once that was accomplished, the balloon burst, and there was nothing else left to do. What Bush proposed in 2004 was, let's set up the ability, let's develop the ability to colonize the solar system. Not just go to the moon, but develop the vehicles and the capability to go everywhere and do it repeatedly. That was the concept. And he didn't say, let's go to Mars. He said, let's go to the moon and beyond and set up a way to do it. So there was no specific goal. It was, let's build the capability. And that, in many ways, is more visionary. And to my mind, it set the stage for giving NASA a purpose it had not had for decades. Now, what Obama will do next, I don't know. As I mentioned in the first thing, there's no clarity yet from this administration on this particular subject. So I can't answer that. I don't know.
All right. Next up, let's go to Culver City, California. Olin, west of the Rockies. Hey, Olin.
Hi there. On May the 5th, 2000, all of the major planets were in a grand alignment all on one side of the sun. That was when the solar light, heat, and mass ejections were at a maximum. Did we have a grand alignment of the planets right before the little ice age?
Oh, no, I don't think that would have been a factor in this. I mean, even when the planets align, the mass of the planets is tiny. It's inconsequential compared to the mass of the sun, and they're very distant away. There are some studies recently that indicate the positioning of the sun, planets could have some effect on the solar cycle, but we're not talking about the grand minimum type thing. It's more complicated than that. There could be it could be a factor, but it would not be the factor. The sun itself determines how that is its cycles and its behavior. The planets could have an effect on that behavior, but it's only going to push and pull it in small directions. It's not going to make it happen.
We're going to Tampa, Florida now. Mike, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Michael.
Hello. My question, two quick questions.
Sure.
The first question is, the U.S. is going to lose, I believe, about half of its weather observation satellite capability over the next 5 years. And I'm wondering if those satellites are going to be replaced, because I haven't heard anything in particular about hurricanes. And the second question is, do you think it would be a good idea for other countries to be put into the International Space Station, for instance, India and China? And those are my two questions.
Thank you. Well, the first question having to do with weather satellites. Launching new weather satellites, the standard satellites that the Weather Channel uses, that is not NASA's job. That's NOAA's job. It's an operational.
Separate budget, right?
Separate budget, separate operation. And they have things in their budget to proceed. There have been problems in recent years keeping that up to date because of budget reasons, because of a lot of reasons. And it's an essential need, so it's ongoing. Where we stand on that, actually, I should check into that. I'm not exactly sure where the status is. I've read things periodically about the problems getting replacement satellites, weather satellites up, but I'm not exactly sure where the status is right this minute. As for International Space Station, first of all, I'm not sure the Chinese, for example, are interested in being part of ISS. They are actually proceeding very independent from everybody else, and they've developed the spacecraft that actually has the capability of developing their own space station, and that seems to be where they're indicating they're going. Their spacecraft is an upgraded version of the Russian Soyuz craft, and so it has an orbital module and a descent module. The descent module is what brings the guys back. The orbital module is an extra room that's attached to the front of the descent module. Well, on the Soyuz craft, the descent module doesn't have any independent power. I'm sorry, the orbital module doesn't have any independent power. Once you eject it, it's basically useless. With the Chinese spacecraft, they added solar panels and an independent operating system. So they've actually, after their last two manned missions, they left the orbital module in orbit and they operated it from the ground independently, unmanned, for several weeks after the mission to test it. It is conceivable that they could launch, every time they launch a spacecraft, they could leave the orbital module up. It's not big, but it's you dock them together and you start to accumulate a station. And it's conceivable that is one direction they might go. They could conceivably also go further and start building larger modules to attach to this. But they are independent-minded. They don't need us necessarily. And when you get into this international cooperative effort, you then have to – it's a committee. You got to get everyone's agreement on everything you do. And if you work independently, you don't have to ask anyone else's permission. You do what you want. And that applies maybe to the Indians as well. The Indians aren't necessarily against or for being part of the International Space Station, but there's advantages not to be locking yourself into that cooperative situation. It gives you freedom and flexibility to build your own and not be tied to everybody else.
How far advanced are the Europeans in that entire space group?
That's an interesting question, George, because, you know, the European Space Agency is kind of like a small version of the International Space Station. You've got a whole bunch of countries supposedly working together. But what it does is it means it's an extremely slow and complicated process to get anything accomplished. They do get things accomplished, but it's slow. The lead nation in the internet in the European Space Agency has always been France. They, in many ways, France worked out a real good deal for themselves. Rather than having to build their own space program all by themselves, they got everybody else to chip in and help them build their space program. Because the Ariane rocket, I would say the main player is France. That's been their game. So yes, they have the Ariane rocket. They have the ATV cargo vessels that can go up to ISS. They've launched one. They have a second one being built and getting ready for launch. And they definitely are committed to ISS. But they are government bureaucracy of very great complexity because they have so many nations involved. So for them to accomplish anything new or innovative is very hard. So that's where they stand. It's very difficult for them to move independently because they got to get agreement from everybody within their own group. And then since almost everything the European Space Agency does is tied to other people like the United States or Russia, it's very difficult for them to accomplish much beyond themselves.
Okay, let's go next to Glenn in Texas, east of the Rockies. Hey, Glenn, go ahead.
Great show, George.
Thanks.
It's a pleasure, Mr. Zimmerman.
Thank you very much, Glenn. I appreciate that.
My ideal space program is a defender of the Earth. Did you recently see a nova where they practically found a smoking gun evidence for an impactor 11,000 years ago?
No, I did not see that show. I do know, the Earth gets hit by asteroids all the, on a regular basis. So that's happened. I'm not sure. So tell me more.
Well, I think we need to lobby for a new approach. We need not the civilian program we need now. We need to have naval architecture involved. We need to build a new shuttle. We need to build a frigate-sized vessel with multiple uses. Could be parked in orbit. Could defend the Earth if need be.
One of the problems, obviously, we all have, and we should be aware of this. For example, there is an asteroid. It has a name. It's called Apophis. I'm sure you've talked about this, George, on your show. It's in orbit. Its orbit will bring it very close to the Earth in 2029, I think is the year. When it passes the Earth at that point, the orbit will get changed slightly, and it will return in 2036. And how it gets changed in 2029 might make it an impact in 2036. And that impact, it's not a small rock. It's a very big rock. It could very seriously damage the Earth badly. And we know about this one. There's about a 1 in 20,000 chance that when the orbit gets changed in 2029, it will hit the Earth in 2036. That is not pleasant odds when you really think about it. So it's no question, the ability to deflect asteroids is a technology we need to develop. The problem I have with almost all proposals people throw out is that if you ask government to do it, you're asking for that large bureaucracy and committee to try to come up with innovation. And NASA does not have a stellar record on innovation in the last 35 years. They just don't. They haven't developed any new engines, any new rockets. Anytime they try to, such as the Ares 1 rocket, they have lots of problems. Budgets go way up. The schedules get really delayed, and it just doesn't happen. You get innovation from competition and private enterprise, where profit is the goal, and that's where we're going to get some of this stuff. That's the only place we're ever going to get it. We have competition today from many nations who are trying to build spacecraft, and that will bring some innovation, which might get us to the goal of being able to save ourselves from asteroids.
When we come back, we'll have final phone calls with Bob Zimmerman right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, in preparation for the 2010 census, census workers are taking coordinates for GPS reasons of every home in the nation. Is that an invasion of your privacy? Catherine Albrecht joins us at the top of the hour as we talk about that. And when we come back, Bob Zimmerman and your final calls on Coast to Coast AM. Bob, if they fix Hubble, will we see things we've never seen before?
Well, yes and no, George. They will do more research in areas that hasn't been done, and there will be discoveries that haven't been discovered before, without question, because the instruments will be more sophisticated. whether they will see, whether there'll be any earth-shattering discovery. It's hard to say. I mean, you know, yes and no. I mean, that's the best I can say. I mean, the instruments are going to be definitely more sophisticated than anything that's been up there before. It's state-of-the-art stuff. So they can now look in places they haven't looked before and see better. Will they be able to see deeper, like do another ultra deep field and see deeper? Actually, probably not. Because I like to say that when Hubble did that deep field, it literally looked as far as the human eye can see. Because beyond that, everything's in the infrared. And so even if you look longer, it won't be visible in optical light. So in that sense, no. But, you know, you aim the telescope at places and at objects that are new discoveries, such as that gamma ray burst that was from 13 billion years ago. If you had a really sophisticated, really good instruments on Hubble, they might have seen things that they couldn't see now because Hubble's somewhat crippled.
Okay, back to the calls we go. Let's go to Bradley driving around in California. You are up with us, Bradley. Hi there.
Hi, George. I have a question for Mr. Zimmerman.
Sure thing.
How has Hubble enabled us to tell the actual age of celestial bodies, such as how do we know the Earth is 4.5 billion years old?
Okay. Well, in terms of the Earth's age, we don't know that from Hubble. What we know that from is a combination of two things. One, data from space and how the other planets form, such as the moon. They've actually done carbon dating of objects on the moon, and it gives them the age of the moon, which gives us a very good idea of when the solar system first formed. So that gives us an idea of when the sun first formed. Similarly, there's other data on Earth that can give us some idea of that. For the age of the universe, Hubble was actually crucial in limiting the date when they think the Big Bang happened. You hear the number 13.7 billion years ago is when the Big Bang happened, and that gives you the impression that they know that number more precisely than they do. Hubble reduced the error bars on the age of the universe to 10%. That means that they think it occurred 13.7 billion years ago, give or take about a billion and a half years. So it could have been 15 billion years ago. It might have been 12 and a half billion years ago. But Hubble at least has allowed us to narrow it down to that range. Before Hubble, the range of the age of the universe was anywhere from like 11, 10 billion years to 20, 22 billion years. They really had no idea. Very wide range. So that's what Hubble allowed us to do. And Hubble did that by looking at various stars in distant galaxies, and we were able to therefore measure the distances of those galaxies more precisely and therefore get an idea of the expansion rate of the universe. And then you extrapolate that expansion rate backwards to the Big Bang, and you have the age of the universe approximately.
Super. Let's go to Linwood, Washington, west of the Rockies. Hey, Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks.
Sure.
Well, I hope that if human beings ever populate another planet, one of these Earth-like planets that Kepler is discovering, that first thing that we should do is ban all war from that planet. But see, the problem I see is that what are you going to do when people start claiming territory? You know, putting stakes in the ground and saying, well, this is mine, this is my territory, don't come in here. And somebody else will say, no, this is my territory, don't come in here. And then you have people fighting over the resources of the land. And before you know it, I mean, look at what's happened on this planet. Look at all these borders on this planet. I would propose that if we ever make it to another planet, that land, it belongs to everybody.
Well, I'm sorry, but I don't believe in communism, and I don't think it works. I actually think that one of the most – I think you're raising a good question, though. One of the most important things that we will do when we establish colonies on another planet is – the most important aspect of that will be the societies we create when we go there. And an interesting thing is that the American nation was a perfect experiment on how one should do that. When the British settled in North America, and this was my master's degree, early American colonial history, Those colonies, all 13 of them, were all formed slightly different from each other. And they experimented, in a sense, with how one should set up a society. And some of their experiments worked better than others. And the United States, when it formed 200 years later after the initial colonization, the founding fathers actually sat there and looked at the different experiments and tried to figure out a way to pick the best elements of those early colonies as societies to create the nation. And the knowledge they gained was applied as the nation settled westward, because America was remarkably successful in incorporating new states into the nation. I mean, one of the reasons the British lost the colonies was they were unwilling to incorporate those colonies into the British empire. They were treating us as second-class citizens. What the United States decided to do is that future states out west should be incorporated, and the citizens should be given the same rights as the initial citizens. Everyone should have the same rights. And they tried to establish fair laws for everyone that lived there. And the result of that is that the United States grew very, as a nation, the new states were added very peacefully. You didn't have wars. You didn't have border wars, not generally, because this nation was established with some justice and rights for all citizens, equal rights for all citizens. If we decide to ban war in space, we're basically telling the citizens of space that they don't have the same rights as people here on Earth. If we tell them they can't own property, we're telling them they don't have the same rights as us on Earth. What we will essentially be doing is setting the groundwork for an eventual revolution, as happened when Britain tried to do the same thing to the American citizens. They deserve the same rights that we here on Earth. Now, having said that, you need to establish that nation, that those colonies, properly. You have to think about the government you establish, the laws that are created, so that the people who live there are given the best opportunity to succeed for themselves. Not for us, for themselves. If you do that, then not only will that space society flourish and grow, but it will provide benefits to everyone here on Earth in amounts we can't even measure, which is, once again, what happened for Britain with the United States. They lost the colonies, but in the end, the success of America, the United States, rebounded to Britain immeasurably for their own benefit. And so the same thing applies in space. So I cannot agree. I would not want to outlaw property rights. I would not want to outlaw, try to write a law that denies the nature of human beings. Instead, you have to try to set up laws that allow nations to establish their territories, their sovereignties, so that they have their rights, and the people that live within those territories have their rights, and can then function as free individuals to achieve the best they can dream. That's how I see it. And if we don't do that, we're only leaving ourselves open for oppressing the people in space, and they will only respond by protest and violence.
Let's go to Santa Monica, California. Douglas, thank you for holding. Go ahead, Douglas.
Yes, Mr. Zimmerman. Very interesting listening to the part of the unknown. Like you say, 50 years from now or 100 years from now or in the past, from Galileo, the same thing. It's very interesting that you're conceived of that everything could be wrong of science right now. And as far as what you said about every infrared only, I would disagree with that regarding the gamma ray bursts. But anyway, Jan Davis, you're familiar with Jan Davis? She was a leader of the team of the structural design of the Hubble telescope.
Jan Davis.
Yes, then she became an astronaut, actually herself.
Oh, yes. Okay, I know the person. I know who you mean.
Became the first married couple in space. Well, anyway, what I'm getting to is the unknowns. Back in the 60s, when they put out the call for telescopes, for the Hubble telescope, I mean, not for the Hubble telescope, for the space telescope. They put out a call for telescopes. Okay, a lot of telescopes were submitted in the 60s. And this one kid, he was really a radio guy. And he had developed a telescope. It was kind of by accident. In the lab, he kept receiving these bursts. in the 63 and 64, 1963 and 64. And he followed on out with, he was working with emission grids of old 1920s huge radio vacuum tubes. He developed a telescope that the astronaut, he was in his opinion of a space telescope, he thought the astronauts were going to go up and be in the telescope in view. Which was, you know, that was his idea. He built a, it was over a square meter platform, and he actually used heat, which is totally against all of the astronomers' ideas of telescopes. They stay away from heat. This telescope actually used heat waves rising up through two rows of vents. It's actually two lenses. Heat rises up with gas through these emission gases from heat. Turns them into gases, runs them through the, like the slits in those old plates in the vacuum tubes or the emission grids. He runs the heat through that, and gravity of the Earth pulls it, the cold air falling down, pulls this down at a perfect speed from gravity, and he starts these rotating, gravitationally rotating lenses, and he had the astronaut lay across the plates and view through these lenses. He thought it would be great because it'd be nice, warm, and cozy, cozy in there.
You know, it's an interesting thing. In the early days when they were first thinking of doing the telescope, they always thought that they would be manned, tended in some manner. Humans would maintain it or service it. In the very early proposals, they thought humans would actually be up there observing. It would be a manned facility. And the astronomers very quickly realized that you put a human being in the telescope, and the human being brings vibration and complexity to the operation, which interferes with the ability for it to operate. I'll use another example. If you're going to take a picture of a faint object, a galaxy, on the ground with your telescope, you don't press a shutter on your camera because you'll shake the telescope and fuzz the image. You got to use a remote shutter control. You can't, you have to keep things very steady. Putting a person in space there is creates that problem. And the end result of that was they decided that the Hubble should be a robot, unmanned. However, it should be maintained by humans periodically. And that combination of humans and robots, Hubble, this is one of the heritages of Hubble that people don't recognize, that is probably the most, one of the most important for the future of the human race. Hubble demonstrated that if you just do robot missions, you limit yourself because robots might be cheap and simple to build, but they can't fix anything. And if something's done wrong, as in a mirror being ground incorrectly, you failed. You don't have an instrument that can function. Humans, meanwhile, if you try to do it only with humans, you find you add a lot of complexity and cost and difficulty, and sometimes it can't work as well. But humans are adaptable and can think and can fix something. If you take the two and you do both, you get the best of all worlds. And when we colonize the solar system, we will not do it just as humans, and we will not do it just as robots. We will use robots to make it easier for the humans to establish places to live in the solar system. And that's the lesson that Hubble has taught us, that if you bring them both together, you can get the best of everything.
All right, you're going to be glued next weekend when the Hubble attempts to get fixed. Huh?
Oh, yeah. It's going to be, it is actually laying out what the future is going to be like routinely in space.
Next up, let's go to Livermore, California. Hello, Mike. Take it away.
Oh, George, great to talk to you once again.
Thanks, Mike.
I had a question for you, but I wanted to say, I was born in 57. The first model I ever made was of the Mercury rocket. And I tell you, I've been hooked since. I just love space and everything about it. My question is, in 2012, the alignment, not just of the planets, but of the whole galaxy, what kind of gravitational pull and what kind of things should we expect? I mean, as the Mayans had put in other prophecies, this is when all the change will take. I guess I'm not really up on my astrology, but it's going from, what, Sagittarius to Aquarius at that time?
Well, Mike, I'm not I'm not a believer in astrology, so I can't really answer that question. I can say this, that as I said to an earlier caller, the planets themselves don't have that much mass compared to, like, the sun. And once you add the great distances involved, that small amount of mass, the amount of gravity they can exert becomes almost infinitesimal. They can maybe affect each planet vaguely in terms of how the orbits resonate with each other. But in terms of any other things, it's minimal. In terms of the galaxy, it's too large. It's too slow moving. You don't get there's not going to be anything significant different in 2012 than there is today in terms of the overall galaxy. Not in terms of at least the alignment of the stars and the planets.
Let's try to squeeze in one or two more. Halifax, Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies. Wayne, go ahead.
Yes, Robert.
Yes.
My idea is just an idea. You know, I'm not the smartest person in the world, but why can't we send up, like, other modules, like extra fuel and food and stuff, and hook it up to a rocket and go to Mars?
You know what? You're pretty smart. That's exactly what Wernher von Braun suggested way back in 1956, that what you do to build a vehicle, an interplanetary vehicle to get to Mars, is you're going to send up multiple modules and you're going to assemble them together to build your spacecraft in orbit. And once it's assembled, you'll send it off to Mars. Well, now think about that. What did I just describe? I just described how we're building the International Space Station.
Sure.
However, in building the International Space Station, politics came in and said, well, we can't really talk about it as an interplanetary spaceship. We'll talk about it as a laboratory. So it's not been designed or built with its basic function in mind, which is teaching us how to build that first prototype interplanetary spaceship. Now, a lot of the engineers involved with it know exactly why they're building it. It's to build that prototype interplanetary spaceship, figure out how to use it, how to build it, what the engineering's involved. They know that, and that's what they're trying to do. The Russians, especially in their part of the station, know it very clearly. And a lot of American engineers at NASA know this very well. They are assembling the first interplanetary spaceship prototype. All you got to really do is put engines on it, and you can take it anywhere. You can't land it maybe on Mars, but you can do a flyby.
Sure.
Now, obviously, ISS, because of the way it was designed, can't actually do that because it was built to work with computers on the ground. It wasn't built as something that would work independent of Earth. That's the mistake. But that's the idea of what a space station really is. You assemble your modules, and once that you got enough equipment and all the parts that you need, you send it off.
Yeah.
That's the basic idea. So you're very smart. You're right on the money.
Okay, thank you so much. Robert, we're out of time, my friend. All your books still available?
Oh, yes, they're all available. Go to my webpage, you can buy them there, you can get them on Amazon, you can get them on Barnes & Noble, you can get them everywhere.
That's Bob Zimmerman. Up next, Catherine Albrecht, as we talk about GPS tagging of your home.